Manned space flight grew out of the early days of the Cold War, a time when it was unimaginable that someday, 40 years later, the United States and Russia would pool their knowledge and their resources to build and operate an international space station. But long before a spirit of cooperation fueled mutual ambitions in space exploration, competition and fear spurred man's desire to rocket into space. And on October 4, 1957, a lone beeping signaled the opening salvo in the space race, accompanied by a boast from Radio Moscow.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
I think before Sputnik, there was not nearly the same sense of a race that was underway.
NASA chief historian Roger Launius talked about the early days of the space race in a 1998 interview with NPR.
Both were competitors technologically, and there had been this competition played out in a variety of other technical fields. I mean, the United States was the first to develop the atomic bomb, but the Soviet Union developed their own in 1949. The United States developed the hydrogen bomb and exploded it in 1953, and the Soviet Union did so just within a very short period of time thereafter. The delivery system for both of those massively destructive weapons looked like it was going to become missiles, and that gets us into the rocket race.
4 months after Sputnik, in January of 1958, the United States responded with its own first orbiting satellite, Explorer 1. And later in 1958, the U.S. launched the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, a federal bureaucracy devoted to space exploration. John Logsdon is director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. In an interview with NPR, he recalled a naive John F. Kennedy, new to the presidency in 1961 and fresh with a desire to work with the Russians on space exploration.
Kennedy came into office with the hope he could cooperate with the Soviet Union in space as one of the areas to reduce tensions between the two Cold War adversaries. And he said so in his inaugural address. He said, let's explore the stars together. 3 months into his administration, Yuri Gagarin was launched. The U.S. and the world political reaction kind of said this was the second strike against the U.S.
The United States strained to respond to Russia's triumph at putting the first man into space, but cosmonaut Gagarin's orbital flight in April 1961 could only be met by the Americans a few weeks later with a modest suborbital mission. Even then, after repeated delays, U.S. astronaut Alan Shepard, Jr., sitting atop a Mercury Redstone missile waiting to become the first American in space, grew impatient and testily told Mission Control, let's light this candle. They finally did.
This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go. 1.2G. Cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go.
America was exuberant, and President Kennedy used the exuberance of America's newfound, yet modest, success in space to establish an almost unimaginably ambitious objective.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
But first, the United States needed to put a man into orbit, and NASA had just the man.
Godspeed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7.
The ambitious future senator and presidential candidate provided a vivid description from his window on the sky.
This is Friendship 7. At this mark, at this present time, I still have some clouds visible below me. The sunset was beautiful. It went down very rapidly. I still have a brilliant blue band clear across the horizon, almost covering my whole window.
Glenn's almost boyish enthusiasm sparked imaginations in America and around the world. Children wanted to grow up and become astronauts, and adults looked to the heavens with a new sense of the horizon. But in January 1967, the United States space program met tragedy. A flash fire erupted inside a three-man capsule during a simulated launch in preparation for the first Apollo mission, a prelude to shooting for the moon. Former NASA flight director Chris Kraft recalled the moment in a March 2001 interview on NPR's Fresh Air.
I heard some screaming. I heard some confused people on the launch pad external to the spacecraft. I heard a voice with which I was very familiar say, "We're on fire." And I heard another voice which I was very familiar with saying, "Get me out of here." And then I heard silence.
The fire killed astronauts Virgil Gus Grissom, Roger Chaffee, and Edward White, and it threatened to slow America's pace in its race for the moon. But former NASA Director of Mission Operations Gene Kranz made certain that the NASA team regained its confidence and determination and that the mission would be accomplished.
We had to start the process of healing and recovery. And I called the control team into the auditorium. This was 2 days after the accident. And I gave them what became known as my tough and competent speech. And I said, from now on, the people of Mission Control will be known by many words, but the two words that will be dominant in our language is tough and competent. Tough meaning we will never again shirk from our responsibilities. We are forever accountable for what we do or what we fail to do. Competent. We'll never again take anything for granted. We'll never stop learning. From now on, this team will be perfect.
That determination and commitment to precision led to a series of successful Apollo missions, Earth orbits, then flights to circle the moon and return home, and finally, in the summer of 1969, the Apollo 11 mission to land on the moon and the fulfillment of Kennedy's ambition.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
The achievement was marked by the first man to set foot on the moon, astronaut Neil Armstrong.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The success of the Apollo 11 mission and then Apollo 12's return to the moon riveted the nation's attention during some of the darkest days of the war in Vietnam. And then, less than a year later, at a time when success in space was beginning to be taken for granted by an overconfident nation, trouble, tens of thousands of miles from home, threatened the calm veneer of NASA's cool astronauts and controllers.
Okay, we got a problem here.
What's the matter with the data you
got? Heater current looks normal.
Okay.
We got more of a problem.
Okay, listen, you guys. We've lost fuel cell 1 and 2 pressure.
We lost O2 tank 2 pressure.
See, you want to look at it?
And temperature.
Okay.
Stand by, they got a problem.
56 hours after liftoff of Apollo 13, an oxygen tank ruptured in the spacecraft's service module. The capsule had already left Earth's orbit on the way to the moon, and the three men aboard struggled to stay alive while engineers on the ground jury-rigged a way to get them safely home. NASA regrouped and recovered and successfully returned to the moon. The moon missions were followed in the 1970s by the trouble-prone but ultimately successful Skylab program. The first orbital workshop was damaged by vibrations during liftoff, but a second mission repaired the station, making it possible to complete a series of medical studies and a handful of experiments designed by school students. Then, in 1975, during the era of détente between the United States and the Soviet Union, the two longtime space competitors cooperated to dock an Apollo capsule with a Soyuz craft.
We are now equalizing the pressure between the docking module and the Soyuz.
Capcom.
Hello.
American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts shook hands in a show of unity that was far more symbolic of eased superpower tensions than any significant scientific achievement. For 2 days, the crews conducted a few experiments, undocked their spacecrafts, and went their separate ways. On the ground, American engineers had long been at work designing a spacecraft that could be launched and returned to Earth to land like an airplane. And on April 12, 1981, Space Shuttle Columbia, the first of the nation's reusable spaceships, lifted off. 2 days later, Columbia's crew did what no other astronauts had done.
He will get ready to slap down the gear any minute now. It's not down yet.
Doing a flat
They're flaring, flaring at about 220. There comes the landing gear.
One.
There's the first touch, a beautiful touchdown. Beautiful.
Columbia was joined by space shuttles Endeavour, Discovery, Atlantis, and Challenger. The ambitious shuttle program became so routine that many Americans were only vaguely aware when a craft was in orbit. Then, on a clear blue morning in late January of 1986, the calm voices of NASA's controllers spoke words that signaled disaster.
Controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
Challenger exploded 73 seconds into flight, killing the shuttle's crew members. President Ronald Reagan spoke to the nation.
We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikulov.
NASA took no chances. The space agency studied and studied the cause of the accident that destroyed Challenger. Early suspicions were confirmed. A leak in one of the spacecraft's solid rocket boosters ignited the main fuel tank, setting off the fatal explosion. More than 2 years passed before the next space shuttle mission. NPR's Ira Flatow was at the Kennedy Space Center for the launch of Space Shuttle Discovery.
There you can hear the main engines have started. Huge white plumes of steam are coming up. There are the solid rocket boosters. We have liftoff. The shuttle has cleared the tower. A big, beautiful orange flame is coming out of the back. It is beginning. The shuttle is beginning to turn on its back and rotate. Sort of like an upside-down flying machine. It is headed straight up into the sky. Up until this point, everything looks beautiful.
Discovery Commander Frederick H. Rick Hauck talked about his feelings and thoughts before liftoff. He recognized the dangers, and he shared the determination that spurred other Americans to return to space following disasters in the past.
If there were to be one, I hope that we would be resilient, but I'm trying to be a realist, and I think that it would be very difficult to bounce back from that. I think that we cannot, as a nation, shrink back from pursuing things that are difficult to do. And if you think they're worthwhile doing, then you got to try again.
For more than a dozen years, until this weekend, the space shuttles lifted off and landed, reused, with experienced and rookie astronauts aboard. The shuttle became a mainstay of space exploration. It carried the Hubble Space Telescope into orbit, and when the telescope turned out to have blurry vision, the shuttle was used to send up a repair crew. The shuttle has also been the essential ferry to carry parts and supplies and crews for the International Space Station, the joint Russian-American project that would have been so unimaginable more than 40 years ago when the space race began. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.